My guest is Will Hutton. Will Hutton is a British journalist and author. He currently writes a regular column for The Observer, is the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, hosts the We Society podcast, and is co-chair of the Purposeful Company. He's also the author of a new book, This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain, which has just been published. Welcome to the podcast, Will.
Glad to be here.
Right, well, actually, it's exactly 4 years since our last podcast, so it's high time that we had a rematch, shall we say. The book for which you're the best known, The State We're In, came out 1996, if I'm not mistaken, in the run-up to an incoming Labour government. This book's coming out now, spring 2024, in the prospect of a quite serious prospect of a Labour government before the end of the year. Is that how you're positioning the book to be some kind of, in a sense, an unofficial manifesto for our new Labour government?
In part. I mean, the title is This Time No Mistakes is kind of addressed at, has got two targets with the title. Target one is that I really want the country to make a decisive break with market fundamentalist laissez-faire thinking, which was revived by Mrs. Thatcher in 1979, has had been pursued by her imitators, and I think has led to a series of kind of catastrophic policy errors, Brexit being one of them, austerity being another, excessive financial deregulation being another, and of course monetarism in the 1980s, which gutted so much of British industry in the areas which were gutted, then voted for Brexit 30 years later. So that's a target. The other target is actually the Liberal left and the Labour Party in particular, because although some of the things that have happened in Britain are part of a kind of global, or certainly a phenomenon across the West, they were most acute here in the UK. And they were most acute here in the UK in part because the Liberal left and the Labour Party in particular did not do enough to intellectually oppose them. So there's a failing, I think, of kind of Liberal left politics to really put together credible philosophy, and then behind it and building on it, a policy program that actually works. So yes, I mean, I want the Labour Party and Keir Starmer and the leadership to kind of take on board these ideas, this trajectory of travel, and not to make a mistake this time.
Right. Well, you make the point in the book and elsewhere that it's semi-self-styled. The Conservative Party is the natural party of government, quote unquote. And it has obviously been in power much more frequently than the Labour government in the past 100 years or so. But if we take slightly arbitrarily a starting point of 1996, the date of publication of The State We're In,
yeah.
In those 28 years, there's been a Labour government for roughly half of that period. So it's not just a question of maybe having a compelling counter-philosophy, as it were. It's also the Labour government's own actions for half of that 28-year period?
Yes. I mean, interestingly, in the build-up and the state we're in, I think, was part of the zeitgeist. But Tony Blair, when he became leader of the Labour Party in 1994, changed the constitution of the Labour Party and rewrote the kind of very kind of high socialist Clause 4 that had been written into the constitution in 1919, calling for the socialisation of the means of production. And he rewrote it, and actually in the rewriting of it, I think captured what I was trying to say in The State We're In, and which I followed through on in this book, which is that the best kind of economic and social order is some combination of the we, the collective, and the I. An ethic of socialism, which speaks to the we and the collective, and the I, which is progressive liberalism, and you need to fuse these two. And actually, my message to the kind of Labour Party, and actually to the and broader than them, to the kind of broad centre in Western electorates, is that philosophy is what most of us are about. Now, the point about New Labour was that having written that constitution, Mr. Blair didn't do very much about it. In fact, resiled from it and allowed, as he openly concedes, a lot of the Thatcherite kind of economics to continue kind of as he inherited it, landing the financial crash of 2007-08, which I'm very critical of. And then there was an attempt to kind of get back on their feet with some of the ideas that I expressed both in The State We're In and in this book, but by then it was too late. So the laissez-faire tradition, this free market fundamentalism, that is kind of very British, and it kind of worked for a period in the 19th century, but not for long. And by the end of the century, it was already obvious to the great new liberal thinkers who would be succeeded by Keynes and Beveridge, who were also new liberals, that actually the whole thing was the basic proposition was not right. You can't put the individual at the centre of the moral, economic and social universe and say that his or her choices are all that's important and that he, she has no obligation to society. You have an obligation to society. The stronger society is, the stronger you are. And it's a two-way flow, it's reciprocal. And one of the great kind of thinkers, Michael Thomas Green, wrote a book called The Polis Obligation, which set this whole thing off. So that basic proposition, which has been repudiated by modern conservatism, so for example, ways your listeners can really get hold of, if someone lives in a council house, they've been given the right to buy the council house. So their individual choice is all that matters. It doesn't matter that you remove that from the stock of social housing and don't replace it, and that you don't give a damn about who's going to live in it in the years to follow. You just take it out. So you sell 4.5 million council houses and you have a homelessness crisis. You know, it's a philosophy that doesn't work at every level, and that's led to Britain being where it is now. So I do, you know, yes, the last kind of 26 years, Labour were in power for a goodly part of them, but they didn't make a decisive break. They left the philosophy intact, and consequently, when the Conservatives took over in 2010, were able to embark upon a kind of such a destructive set of policies, which has actually, paradoxically, not only been very destructive for British economy and society, but very destructive to them as a political party. They have failed so completely that, you know, whereas in large parts of Europe, the right are in the ascendant, you know, in Britain, the right has absolutely fragmented. The Conservative Party has collapsed into kind of warring cults. It has no kind of internal coherence as a political party. There's populist right-wing parties kind of on the fringes like Reform. But actually, so mistaken has kind of this kind of right agenda been that actually it opens the way, almost the only country in Europe, certainly the only major country in Europe, for a decisive kind of left-to-centre victory at the general election that'll be later this year.
Let's briefly go back to first principles, if I may. The book is very much underpinned by these two philosophies of ethical socialism and progressive liberalism. Now, most people would assume that all socialism is ethical and all liberalism is progressive. So why have you added those adjectives?
Well, socialism in practice leads to kind of monopoly control by the state of substantial parts of production and even distribution. And I don't believe in monopoly, either in state control or in private control. It doesn't work. You need lots of runners and riders. You need experimentation. You need innovation. And so the socialism in practice turned out to be something rather oppressive. And actually, in the act of possessing a monopoly, becoming oppressive meant it departed from its ethic. Now, the ethic of socialism has its roots in kind of Aristotelian thinking, you know, that a man or a woman who says they do not need to partake of society is either a beast or a god, he wrote. Well, you know, and I wanted no truck with either. You know, thinkers, it's there in religion. I mean, the great, you know, Christianity is built upon the notion that, you know, you are kind of, when you take communion, you are kind of one congregation partaking of the blood and the body of Christ and sharing in it as one group.
Right.
This is an ethic, and it's very deep in people's sensibility. You know, we have each other's backs, we believe in mutuality, but we believe in fellowship, which is how the great Labour leader Clem Attlee defined socialism. That's an ethic, and it's different from turning it into kind of monopolistic control by the state, and it's very important to differentiate between the two. Progressive liberalism is very important to use the word progressive, because classic liberalism does put the individual at the heart of things.
Okay.
I mean, with John Stuart Mill's work, he says, you know, you shouldn't even put a sign on a path leading to a cliff over which you might fall to your death, because that would be an intrusion of the state in your free choices.
Right.
Nonsense, actually. But actually, that was classic liberalism. The progressive liberal said, no, the individual is obviously important, but he, she has obligations to society and society to him or her. So that's why I use those words, ethic and progressive.
Right. Well, to quote some of your words back at you, and maybe this is part of your unofficial manifesto for the upcoming Keir Starmer government, quote, the task could be seen not as socialising capitalism, but as harnessing and humanising it so that it serves the common good in a society where everyone can flourish, a joint project of ethical socialists and progressive liberals. Do you
that's
see
it,
those
that's
two?
That's it. That's it.
They
well
all
read.
Word. They all word. Thank
well,
you.
Well read. What good words are those?
Well expressed. But in reality, how feasible are these two strands in terms of working together? You're trying to maybe solidify and make more confident a more centre-left alliance?
Yes. I mean, I think there's all kinds of areas where this could be put into practice. I mean, I'll give a couple of examples. I mean, one, I mean, I think that every business model, every business has a business model, and nearly all these business models depend one way or another on kind of the public. You know, it could be a license, it could be, you know, if you're a regular utility, it's a license to operate. It could be, you know, depending on some R&D that's been paid for by the government of the day. It could be, you know, getting a big order from the government to pilot a new vaccine. You know, wherever you look, you know, there is businesses kind of has a reciprocal kind of relationship with public agency, and you know, the kind of mythology is that kind of all these entrepreneurs run around are wealth creators off their own back and don't need all that. The honest truth is, every single one of them who's self-knowing knows that actually, kind of, the people they employ are educated and trained, the contracts they're getting have been helped along in some part by the state. You know, you need public agency, you need the we, you need, if you like, the progressive liberalism and the ethical socialism goes hand in hand. They know that. You know, it is a world in which you have a floor and a ladders. It's a world in which, you know, you kind of try to make sure that everybody kind of knows there's kind of a minimum level of social provision below which they can't fall. At the same time, you're offering kind of ladders of opportunity upward. And I mean, I ran an Oxford College for 9 years of my life, and they call the academics who kind of, you know, own the college as a charity are called fellows, and it's a fellowship. And I didn't realize just how much that meant. I mean, these men and women, these academics who are very individualistic, kind of actually own the notion that they kind of, that this college and its academic kind of vocation, they hold it in trust, and they understand that it's a collective we. And they also kind of individually are very aggressive about their academic interests and guarding them jealously.
Right.
So they you know, in their, you know, from their day-to-day life, they're simultaneously kind of owning the idea that they're part of a collective and behaving individualistically. It's not, I mean, actually, that's the way you live, Paul. It's the way I live. It's the way we all live. And this idea that, you know, they're opposing theologies that actually can't touch one another, and that you can either have to go all the way with one,
right,
like kind of, I don't know, Donald Trump or Liz Truss or whoever, or go all the way with another, a kind of ferocious kind of socialist, or kind of at the margin, you know, what happened in Eastern Europe before the Cold War ended. I mean, it's madness.
Is that
madness.
Why you talk about this idea of an agile state? And maybe explain what you mean by an agile state.
An agile state. I mean, if you argue, as I do, that the good society is about fusing kind of the we and the I, and it's about offering a floor and simultaneously offering ladders of opportunity upward within a capitalism, by the way, that is purposeful, stakeholder-oriented, and kind of puts and wants to make profit from delivering great purpose. In that kind of world just doesn't happen spontaneously. Mm. It has to be created and designed. And we look to the democratic state to do that. And by the way, that's why democracy and capitalism go hand in hand. And if the state is to do that, I mean, things are constantly changing. I mean, we live in an era of the fourth industrial revolution, there's artificial intelligence. I mean, your listeners know all that, throwing up kind of fantastic opportunity and great threats. That has to be managed. That has to be managed by somebody, and that somebody is the state. And because things are so fast moving in 2024, the state can't be ponderous. It's got to be more agile. It's got to be more alert to what's going on and act faster. And to do so legitimately, it has to have kind of much cleverer and smarter ways of actually understanding where public opinion is, testing public opinion and acting on it, and kind of checking back to make sure it's doing the right thing. If what it's trying to do doesn't work out, quickly dropping it and moving on to something else or trying something else. So, you know, it's a much more... And people say, have you ever seen an agile state in action? Well, I would say, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal was an agile state in action in the time. And I devote a whole chapter to that because I think it's so important to kind of get that understood. I think that actually, I mean, the British state in both world wars was extraordinarily agile. Right. And war production in Britain in both the 1418 War and the 39-45 War, and this is not commonly known, outstripped the Axis powers. You know, we were a fantastic producer. The agile state actually making sure that there were kind of guns, planes, tanks in vast quantities. And we were pretty agile too during the COVID crisis. And if the state puts its mind to it, it can actually do this stuff. And what I'm saying is, it's not just a one-off thing. It's got to be constant. It's got to be it's got to be embedded in civil society permanently.
Right. We have to move on. There's so many things to talk about and so little time. Electoral reform. You've said that the time has come when we have to take the way we vote more seriously. You're making a plea there, a pretty obvious plea for proportional representation.
Yes. I mean, we can't carry on like this. I mean, first past the post is such a crude way. If you want an agile state, it has to be legitimate, it has to be democratic, and it has to be reflect public opinion. And that requires that every single citizen knows that his or her, you know, views are reflected in the composition of both the House of Commons and democratically elected House of Lords, the second chamber. And that can't be done by first past the post. And actually, for the last kind of 150 years in Britain, since the 1885 Reform Act, we've had this first past the post. It's kind of led to so many occasions where the government of the day has not reflected public opinion and done things which are so out of kilter with public opinion. It's kind of partly led to the crisis that we're in. So there's a democratic story. There's also an ineffective government story. It's also a 21st century story. I mean, you know, we live in a world in which people are educated. They're self-knowing. I mean, they want to be engaged. They want to make a contribution. And actually saying, well, you know, if there's living in parts of the country where your vote simply doesn't matter because you know whatever you think, it doesn't, but you're going to be overwhelmed by others. It's an impossible proposition. The time has come for proportional representation.
But the two main parties, including obviously the Labour Party, it's not exactly their top of their list of priorities.
No, it's not. I mean, in fact, the Tories have been fiddling around with the voting system so that the mayoral elections in London coming up on the beginning of May will be done in a first-past-the-post system because they think it's going to be advantageous to their candidates, and it might be. And second voters' second and third preferences, which used to be taken into account, have been written out of the script. It's a real step backwards, and not enough is written about that or talked about. No, I mean, the Tories shamelessly, back in the end of the 19th century, I mean, Tories used to say, you know, the way we can make sure that the 20th century is our century is if we keep the opposition vote divided between Liberals and the rising Labour Party and maintain first past the post. They understood it at the end of the 19th century, and the 20th century was their century largely because of that. And now, of course, the left's thinking, well, maybe, you know, the Tories are so fragmented, it'll work in reverse. I don't care. I mean, it's about what civilization you want to live in, what kind of democracy you live in. If it falls out that actually the centre-right win the political argument, then it's quite appropriate that they should actually form the majority in the House of Commons. You know, come on. The job in a democracy is to make sure they don't win the political argument. But, I mean, that's what it's all about. And out of that political argument comes good things.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm one side of it, but I respect the others.
Okay, we're going to have to finish this quite soon. You won't be surprised by my saying the last part of this great conversation should be about the European Union, UK's relations with the European Union. You say, again, your words, quoting your words back at you, perhaps the only unexpected benefit of Brexit is that it has been such an obvious failure. And you go on to say, reassociating ourselves with the EU is not just vital, it cannot be dodged. To what extent do you think the Labour Party, even now in opposition, has sympathy with that view?
Well, Keir Starmer came to an event, some days after the book was published, and said the book was brilliant.
That's quite an endorsement.
And he particularly liked the conclusion from which you just drawn those quotes. Labour Party members are overwhelmingly pro-European. Look, I mean, we live in a country where the kind of right-wing ecosystem, you know, the think tanks, the media, and the party itself, and people's kind of basic kind of leanings, actually, are kind of very conservative. Although I'm not sure that the public's leanings are that conservative. It's just that they have such a megaphone, it exaggerates their influence. Now, I don't think that the British actually are Europhobes, actually, or anti-Europe. And I mean, I think they regarded it rather like a membership of NATO until it was flamed up into this kind of big ideological divide by the Brexiters in the kind of the run-up to that 2016 referendum. But, you know, needs must.
Yeah.
Needs must. We need the European Union. If you're going to get growth, we need access to the single market and the customs union. We actually need freedom of movement, actually. I mean, we're suffering. That's only one element of it. We must be in the room and be part of the conversation in our continent about what to do about, you know, Putin's aggression, what to do about the rise of Hindu nationalism, what to do about kind of the really perilous situation in the Middle East, what to do about climate change, what to do about artificial intelligence and data. I mean, the idea that these are kind of, that these can be handled by one kind of middle-ranking European country and the rest can go, we don't care about the rest of the world, what the rest of Europe, it's just madness. So there's that. And then there's a third thing, which I feel very strongly. After the war, you know, Britain made a choice in 1932 to kind of look to the empire to save itself from the slump and all the consequences of the Great Recession. And even as late as 1970, Britain was running a system of imperial preference, even as late as 1970.
Right.
And the politicians of that time, the Macmillans, the Ted Heaths, the Harold Wilsons, the Roy Jenkins, kind of who'd all fought in the war, by the way, understood that actually empire was disappearing, was decolonization was taking place. What was Britain's destiny? And it was their answer, as men who'd fought a war and didn't want a war again in Europe, was actually it was Europe. And it answered the question, what about Britain's destiny? The Brexiters kind of reopened that file, kind of, you know, in the 2010s to say, no, you know, our destiny is to carry on where kind of Lord Salisbury left off in 1900, splendid isolation, you know, free trade, kind of global Britain,
yeah.
All this nonsense. As if we had a fleet that was, you know, the equal to the size of the next five fleets. Actually, our fleet consists of 19 vessels. You know, I mean, it's such a kind of make-believe kind of fantastical world. It's kind of breathtaking, actually. And that they're also belief in kind of in laissez-faire fundamentalism, which Keynes said, let's kill it, 100 years ago. So, you know, this kind of way of thinking is kind of wholly outmoded. So if you're going to make a decisive break with that, it's not only about kind of marrying the we and the I. It's not only about an agile state. It's not also about having a kind of capitalism that works for the common good. It's also recognizing that one's place as a country is in the world, and it sits firmly, squarely in the European Union. I said it in the book, and the leader of the Labour Party endorses the book.
Right. Well, we have to leave it there. Will Hutton, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.